Now, we're beginning on January the 4th, 1924. And this is volume 16. So this is the words of Jesus in the garden, not my will, but yours be done. This has to be our motto. Okay, so this is a very important message. I was thinking about the words of Jesus in the garden when he said, Father, if it be possible, let this chalice pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done. And my sweet Jesus, moving in my interior, told me, my daughter, do you think it was because of the chalice of my passion that I said to the Father, Father, if it is possible, let this chalice pass from me? The vast majority of scholars say yes, he was afraid to die, which means, of course, they're not really accepting his divinity as well as his humanity. Not at all, Jesus said. It was the chalice of the human will, which contains such bitterness and such fullness of vices that my human will, united with the divine, felt such repugnance, terror and fright as to cry out, Father, if it be possible, let this chalice pass from me. How ugly is the human will without the divine will, which almost as within a chalice enclosed itself in each creature. There's no evil in the generations of which it is not the origin. That's the human will. The human will is not the origin, of which the human will is not the origin, the seed and the fount. Now, what Jesus is saying here is that it was the chalice of the human will in rebellion to the divine will that made him pray like this. But you have to go to the sixth hour of the Passion, okay? And when you go to the sixth hour of the Passion, you have Jesus agonizing in the garden and you have him saying three times to the Father, not my will, but thine be done. Now, Louise is going to give you a different reason there for this prayer than she's giving you here. Because in the sixth hour of the Passion, Jesus says that the thing that is costing him the most is that souls who would rebel against the divine will would be lost. Now, it's still the human will against the divine. But it's a completely different aspect of the problem. And this is where, when we're looking at these writings, we have to compare what was said in one place with another so that we're seeing a bigger picture. OK. And Jesus said, in seeing myself covered with all of these evils produced by the human will, before the sanctity of my will, I felt myself dying. Now, Louisa does describe him that way in the Garden of Gethsemane. And indeed, I would have died if the divinity had not sustained me. Okay. Now, the thing that strikes me there is that the kingdom of the divine will is really established here in Gethsemane, where he, on behalf of the whole human race, says, not my will, but thine be done. And we have to enter into that at such a level that it actually represents where I'm at in my life, that my attitude to God is not my will, but thine be done. And if we are sincere about that, the Lord will give you exercise to see, is it really true? And what I mean by that is, if you say, Lord, not my will, but thine be done, you'll find people walking over your will. You'll find people going contrary to your will. And the exercise is, yes, I really mean it. Not my will, but thine be done. And what I find in my life anyway, is that every now and then the Lord gives you a whole spate of things where the lesson every single time is not my will, but thine be done. I had an entire morning of it very, very recently where everything went against me. Absolutely everything I tried to do. And I just said, not my will, but thine, not my will, but thine. It was absolutely everything. And then the whole thing stopped. And I realized it was an exercise. sometimes we don't register that what is happening to us is an exercise from above, and that if we give the response that the Lord is looking for, that the need for the exercise is then taken away. In other words, the teacher says, okay, they got it. They got the message. So we have to make absolutely sure that my attitude to God is permanently, not my will, but thine be done. And if your will isn't crossed, please come back and tell the rest of us how you manage. But Jesus said, do you know why I added, and as many as three times, not my will, but thine be done? I felt upon myself all the wills of creatures united together. You see, he's saying it on our behalf. He didn't have to say it on his behalf. He's saying it on our behalf. And we're all incorporated into him. I felt, he said, all of their evils. And in the name of all, I cried out to the Father, may the human will be done on earth no more. Now, if you know the level of crisis that's in the earth today, one of the things that we have to do is enter into the divine will and unite with the divine will, and in the name of the human race, say, not my will, but thine be done. Not my will. So you're like Jesus, you're saying it also on behalf of everybody else, not just on your own behalf. Because it's one thing to say it for yourself, it's quite another matter to say it for everybody else. So may the human will be done on earth no more, only the divine. May the human will be banished, and may the divine will reign. So that's a prayer we've got to start doing frequently, particularly now when there's an enormous amount of rebellion against God around. So even from that time, and I wanted to do this at the very beginning of my passion, because the calling upon earth of the fiat voluntas tua on earth as it is in heaven was the thing that interested me the most important one. So here he's saying that at the very beginning of his passion, he's calling upon the era of the fulfillment of the Our Father. He was the one who gave us the prayer of the Our Father, that the most important thing was to honour God and to do God's will. So here he's crying out for it to actually be fulfilled. And I think we need to cry out for it to be fulfilled on a daily basis as well. We need to cry out on a daily basis for it to be fulfilled. So this was the most important thing for me, Jesus said. I myself said, in the name of all. You see, all our prayers in the divine will are in the name of all. Non mea voluntas sed tua fiat, not my will, but thine. From that time, I constituted the era of the fiat voluntas tua on earth. That's why you have to put a VIP on this particular text. Because if people ask you, what was the moment in which he declared the kingdom of the divine will open? It's at this moment when he says to God, the Father, not my will, but thine be done. And he's saying it on behalf of everybody else. So he now wants the human will on earth to cease. So from that time, I constituted the era of the fiat voluntas tua on earth. And by saying it as many as three times, in the first one, watch this, I prayed for the divine will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. In the second one, I made the divine will descend. And in the third one, I constituted the divine will ruler and dominator. And in saying, not my will, but thine be done, I intended to empty the creatures of their wills and to fill them with the divine. So he's speaking to the Father on our behalf, and he's constituting the new era to come into existence. So his own prayer will be fulfilled. Okay. So before dying, since I had only a few hours left, I wanted to negotiate with my celestial Father my primary purpose for which I came on the earth, that the divine will might take its first place of honour in the creature. Now, notice it's first place. First place. This has been the first act of man to withdraw from the divine will. And therefore, it was our first offence. Now, here he is in the very first stage of the passion and he's dealing with it. So first things first. So what is the most important thing dealing with the human will? So I want to give you Psalm 106, verse 23. Jesus is standing in the breach, as Moses did before him, between God's justice and our sinfulness. And he's praying the new situation into existence. Psalm 106, verse 23. He said, all other evils are in the secondary order. Now, why are they in the secondary order? It's because they all follow the rebellion of the human will. If the human will didn't rebel, the other evils wouldn't show up. And therefore, it's dealing with the human will has got to be done first. Therefore, first I had to accomplish the purpose of the fiat voluntas tua on earth as it is in heaven, to then form the redemption with my pains. In fact, redemption itself is in the secondary order. Why is that? Because if the human will hadn't rebelled, redemption wouldn't have been needed. It is always my will that has primacy in all things. That's why I've been saying for years that our motto has got to be, not my will, but thine be done. And even though it was the effects of the fruits of redemption that could be seen, it was by virtue of this contact which I made with my divine Father that his fiat was to come and reign upon the earth. Realizing the true purpose for the creation of man, which was to do God's will. I think the Penny Catechism said it very well, to know, love and serve God on the earth and be with him forever. We need to bring it back, you know. We'll never improve on the answers that were in the Penny Catechism because they were so succinct and theologically profound. Absolutely fantastic. So this was the true purpose of the creation of man and the primary purpose for which I came on the earth. That is to deal with the rebellion of the human will and to restore the divine will to the earth. That man received the fruits of the redemption. Otherwise, my wisdom would have lacked order. Now, one of the things that's very, very clear in Louise's writings is the divine order of God. Everything has got to be in order. If the beginning of evil was man's will, it was man's will that I was to reorder. Look at the words. And restore, reorder because it's out of order, restore to the divine will, reuniting the divine will and the human will. And even though the fruits of redemption could be seen first, this says nothing. My will is like a king who, though he is first among all, he arrives last, being preceded for his honour and decorum by his peoples, his armies, his ministers, his princes and his royal court. Now, what Jesus is describing there is a Roman triumphal procession where all the army and all everything goes before the triumpher. The triumpher is actually last. OK. So it's the triumphal procession. So the fruits of redemption were needed first, so that the height of the majesty of my will. Now, notice the height. That's one of the words that's consistent in Louisa for supreme. It's the supreme majesty of God. And when she says that the height of the Blessed Mother, she's talking about the supreme holiness of the Blessed Mother, the height. And it's just that nowadays we use the word supreme more than height. So that the height or the supremacy of the majesty of my will might find the royal court, the peoples, the armies and the ministers. In other words, it takes time for this procession to pass by. So He's going to bring in two words corresponding to each other, contract, covenant. Okay. Do you know who was the first one to cry out together with me, not my will, but thine be done? It was my little newborn of my will. My little daughter, who felt such repugnance and fright at her will that trembling she clung to me and cried out with me, Father, if it is possible, let the chalice of my will pass from me. Can I suggest you take that off the page, put it on a little card and put it somewhere where you're going to see it every single day. That's the most wonderful prayer to pray to the Lord. Father, if it be possible, let the chalice of my will, because my will is the source of all my problems, let the chalice of my will pass from me. And crying, you add it with me, not my will, but thine be done. And yes, you were together with me in that first contract with the Celestial Father, because at least one creature was needed in order to validate the contract. In other words, he always needs at least one person representing humanity. Now, I always translate that into, he needs one drop of water in his wine. And that little drop of water in the wine that I look at every day at Mass, I think it's so important. We just don't realise the importance of it. That's us, our tiny participation. Okay. I needed one creature at least in order to validate the contract. Somebody on the earth had to say yes. So the more of us who are saying yes, the more powerful it is in history. Otherwise, to whom would I give it? To whom would I entrust it? And in order to render the custody of the contract more secure, I gave you all the fruits of my passion as a gift, he's saying to Louisa. Now, up to this moment, the only thing we knew was that only one person had experienced all the fruits of the passion and all the fruits of redemption, and that was our Blessed Mother. But Louisa has reached such height herself in her relationship with God that this is what Jesus is saying now. So the commentary that I have in my margin is, wow. I don't think it requires anything else. And he said, I lined them up around you like a formidable army, which while forming the royal cortege of my will, wages a fierce war against your will. Now, all the tussles that you see between Jesus and Louisa in these writings, it's the divine will making absolutely certain her human will isn't going to shift even remotely. It's absolutely fantastic. And therefore, in our efforts to live the divine will, the Lord is saying to us, he has to love us more than we love ourselves. And so if our will is shifting away from him, then he has to do something to make you come back. And he calls it waging war on you. Do you find that interesting? Now, war isn't comfortable. Therefore, courage in the state that you are in. In other words, you're called to be a hero. Dismiss the thought that I may leave you. She's always accusing him of that. It would be detrimental to my will. Why? Because the divine will needs somebody on the earth to sign the contract. Okay. Since I keep the contract of my will deposited in you. So remain at peace. It is my will that tests you, wanting only to purge you and to destroy even the shadow of your will. Okay, it's my will that tests you. For some reason, I have Exodus 25:22 there, and I forget why I put it there. Exodus 25:22. It's my will that tests you, wanting only to purge you and to destroy even the shadow of your will, because the more our will is literally put aside, the more the plan that the divine will has for the human race on earth can be fulfilled. The more of us who actually make this surrender. So, in all peace, Continue your flight in my volition and be concerned with nothing. Colossians 3:15 and Philippians 4:7, the peace that passes all understanding. Your Jesus will make it so that everything which may happen inside and outside of you will make my will stand out even more and will expand within you the boundaries of my will in your human will. So with this surrender, if we actually leave it to him, you hear him saying frequently to Louisa, Louisa, let me do, let me do. Just give me a bit of freedom to do this. And if we let him do it, then he expands his divine will in us. He expands our soul to be able to take what he's offering to us. And everything will be accomplished. So it's all in the surrender. I myself will keep the pace in your interior, that I may direct everything in you according to my will. Now, that sentence, that part of the sentence there, that I may direct everything, is Deuteronomy 32:12. The Lord alone was his guide. I occupied myself with nothing but the will of the Father alone. And since all things are in his will, I occupied myself with everything. I'm just going to give you two examples here out of many. John 5:30 and John 8:29. 5:30 and 8:29. I only do what my Father tells me to do. I only say what my Father tells me to say. The Father and I are one, and all the rest of it. John's Gospel is great for illustrating that. And if I taught only one prayer, it was no other than this, that the divine will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. But it was the prayer that enclosed everything, because it was the human will that destroyed God's plan. So the divine will taking over will restore God's plan. So I did not move, if not around the supreme will. The whole of John's Gospel attests to that. My words, my pains, my works, my heartbeats were filled with the celestial will. So I want you to do. Now, if you put that into ordinary English, I want the same from you. And I think you need to colour that one if you colour things. Because the Lord is saying, this is what I want from you. You must go around in the divine will so much as to let yourself be burned by the eternal breath of the fire of my will. Now, the breath of God is Ruach Adonai. That's the Spirit of God, the Ruach Adonai. And the fire of the divine will, Deuteronomy 4:24 and Hebrews 12:29, our God is a consuming fire. Now, you know from many of the texts that we've done already that Louisa does experience this consuming fire. She even says, I feel I'm being consumed inside, without really knowing what it is. But in the hours of the Passion, you hear her praying, let your fire burn me up. Yeah, and you're talking about the human will there. Okay. So January the 14th, 1924. So this is the stripping and the scourging of Jesus. What you find in Louisa's writings is that you will get a group of messages all around the same subject. So Louisa said, I was accompanying the mystery of the scourging. I was sympathizing with my sweet Jesus when he saw himself so confused in the midst of his enemies. Now, you have to ask yourself, why is the word confused put there? Because when we say somebody is confused, we're saying they don't get it. Okay, that's not what she's saying. Okay, so watch out for this now. Stripped of his garments under a storm of blows. So, my beloved Jesus, coming out of my interior in the state that he was in when he was scourged, told me, my daughter, do you want to know why I was stripped when I was scourged? Now, nothing happened to him that the divine will did not ordain. And therefore, every single motion of the Passion has incredible treasure for us understanding who Jesus is and how he relates to us and the meaning of the whole of redemption. Okay, so that's what he's going to talk about. So why did I let it happen? In each mystery of my passion, first I occupied myself with joining the split between the human will and the divine. So that's number one all the time. And then with the offenses which this split produced. So first of all, it's the split between the human and the divine, then the sins that came out of that. When man in Eden broke the bonds of the union between the supreme will and his will, he stripped himself of the royal garments of my will. And he clothed himself with the miserable rags of his will. So he became weak, inconstant, impotent for doing any good. Okay. So that is the description of the prodigal son in Luke 15, verses 13 to 17. Miserable, inconstant, impotent in doing any good and reducing himself to an absolute misery. You also have Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 6. Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 6 and verse 15. Now that's the demoniac who reduces himself to an absolute wreck because of the destructive. Are you all right? Luke 15, verses 13 to 17. And Mark 5, verses 1 to 6 and verse 15. Now, in both cases, for the demoniac and for the prodigal son, you are told that when they returned to the father, they were clothed. Okay. I want to take you back to Genesis. And when you're told in Genesis chapter 2 that man was created, you're told he was not wearing clothes as we wear clothes, but he was not naked. When he rebels against the will of God in chapter 3, you are then told that man is naked. So in the Bible and in these writings, which speaks in this exact same language as you have in the Bible, nakedness has to do with the loss of grace. It's nothing to do with physical clothes. It's to do with the loss of grace. Now, there's an absolutely extraordinary text at the other end of the Bible. I've taken you from Genesis to Revelation. Revelation 16, 16. You're told, happy is the man who has stayed awake and has not taken off his clothes, so that he does not go out naked to expose his shame. Now, I'm quite sure John is not speaking about streaking. What John is saying is, you are in the final chastisement. Make sure that the garment of grace that was given to you in baptism is still on. Because without your garment of grace, you are going to a terrible destiny. So I just want you to hear in these writings and in the Bible that clothing is grace, nakedness is exposure to evil. And a person who is naked, has no grace, is totally exposed to the attacks of the evil one. Okay. So there you have the prodigal son and the demoniac and all the rest of it. So let's come to the next point then. My will was a sweet enchantment for him. So this is an attraction that God is continuously giving to the human race, which kept him absorbed within a most pure light, which made him know nothing but his God. Now, this is pre-fall. This is genuine innocence. You don't know evil. OK, you see no evil, you hear no evil and you speak no evil. So he knew nothing but his God from whom he had come and who gave him nothing but innumerable happiness. We would say much happiness because my book has happiness S, which is not English. So you can say innumerable happiness S if you're not talking English. God gave him plenty of happiness. Okay. And he was so absorbed in the generosity of his God to him. I'm trying to put English on this. Is that okay? That he would not give a thought to himself. So here's the human will now married to the divine will. Now, you know that when the snake appeared, that the snake said, but you don't know everything, you don't know evil. God's keeping an awful lot away from you, and God is painted as the big baddie. Okay. Oh, how happy man was, and how the divinity delighted in giving him so many particles of his being. Now, that's the bit you colour. What was it that the Lord was giving the man? God can only give himself. And there's only one model, and that's God himself. So God was giving him so many particles of his own being, for as many as the creature can receive, in order to make him similar to himself. So there's you have your Genesis 1:27. He is made in the image of God, as God shares particles of his own being. So as soon as he broke the union with our will, he lost the royal garment. Now, for us, that's the garment of baptism. Okay. But the context in which we're reading here, it's that he lost the divine will. That's the biggest garment of all. He lost the enchantment, he lost the light, and he lost the happiness. He looked at himself without the light of my will, and in looking at himself without the enchantment that kept him absorbed, he came to know himself, that means in a carnal manner. He felt ashamed and he became afraid of God. Sin makes us afraid of God because it automatically produces in us the understanding that we will face judgment. Okay, so that's Genesis 3:10. And this was such that his very nature felt the sad effects of this. He felt the cold and he felt his nakedness and he felt the vital need to cover himself. This is all the result of this so-called enlightenment. Notice I say so-called. Just as our will kept him within the port of immense happiness, knock out the ES, so did his will put him in the port of miseries. So you've been shown clearly here, the human will is the source of misery and pain and sin and death and hell. Our will was everything for man. And in our will, he found everything. It was right that having come out of us and living in our will as our tender child, that he would live of the divine will. So all his acts would be in the divine order. And this will was to make up for everything that he needed. Now, you hear Jesus saying that to Louisa all the time about her relationship with him, that he will give her everything she needs. Therefore, as man wanted to live of his own will, he became needy of everything. Now, that is actually something you should underline. Because the human will does not have the power to make up for all his needs. In fact, one of the most basic realities in the world today, and I'm going to illustrate it for you, is that people have an ache in the depths of their being. And this ache, they can't put a name on it. And it sort of reads, I want something and I don't know what I want. I'm sure you've felt it, haven't you? And they'll do anything to try and drown this need. They'll drink it off, and then when they get sober again, it's still there. They'll go out and have a nice meal with friends, and when they've spent the money and the friends and they come home in the middle of the night, it's back. Because it is the soul crying out for God. That's actually what it is. That desperate need. And Adam didn't know that need until he had given up the divine will and he was back depending on himself. Let me give you a very, very, very simple example, because we're trying to help each other to give examples, aren't we? A child in the middle of the family has all the needs met and the parents take care of everything. Let the child wander out onto the street by itself and in no time at all, Its name is need. I know of a certain person whose little son at the age of 6 decided he was leaving home. He'd had enough. So everybody was deficient and he was gone. And the mother just happened to be rather wise. And she said, that's fine. I mean, you're a man. You can go. And when he got to the edge of the garden, she said, by the way, did you take your pyjamas? Oh, no, that was a bit awkward. He hadn't thought of that. She said, how are you going to manage tonight? Oh, that worried him a little bit. And then she said, have you got any money? And he said, money? She said, yeah, out there in the big bad world, you have to pay for the food you eat and the anything you drink. And if you want to stay in anybody else's house, you're going to have to pay for it. She was talking to a six-year-old. And she went on like this for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then the fella said to her, it's too complicated, I'll go back. I just think it's a really nice illustration that you leave the comfort and the wonder of that relationship that supplies all your needs and your name becomes need. That is what Jesus is saying here. Do you see that you don't have to give sophisticated examples? Life is full of illustrations of what the Lord is saying here. And I love that the little fella saying, no, it's too complicated, I'll go back. So he decided to put up with them. He's wonderful. So now that man has broken from the will of God, he wanted to live of his own will, so he became need. Instead of just saying needy of everything, I would just say he became need. Yeah. Have you ever gone to the Lord and said, I am need? Try it. But, I mean, it has to be the truth. Because if you try it, I did. He said, I am plenty. I said, I am a sinner. He said, I am your saviour. I am hungry. He said, I am your food. And I was trying to think of things then so that the dialogue would continue. And every time I said something, he had the solution to it. He is our happiness, our peace, our everything. Okay, but we're need. By ourselves. The human will does not have the power to make up for all our needs, nor does it contain the fount of good within itself. There's your John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. The good, the source of good is not in us. It's in God. So, man was forced to procure for himself with hardship the necessary things of life. Do you see then what it means not to be united with my will? Oh, if all knew the divine will, they would have one yearning, and that would be that my will would come to reign upon the earth. So, had Adam not withdrawn from the divine will, his nature also would have had no need of clothing. Isn't that interesting? And his nature would have had the integrity and the health and absolutely everything it was created in. He would not have felt ashamed of his nakedness, nor would he have been subject to suffering cold, heat, hunger and weakness. But these natural things were almost nothing. Rather, they were symbols of the great good that his soul had lost. I think that's a wonderful piece, isn't it? So who's going to pay for getting the divine clothing given back to us? Therefore, my daughter, before being tied to the pillar to be scourged, I wanted to be stripped in order to suffer and repair for the nakedness of man. When he stripped himself of the royal garment of my will, I felt such confusion and pain within me in seeing myself stripped in the midst of enemies who were mocking me that I cried over the nakedness of man, and I offered my nakedness to the celestial Father so that man might be clothed once again with the royal garment of my will. So now you see the confusion is explained. He had to take on all the reaction that man experienced in breaking with the divine will. And he had to experience it. So for him, as the Son of God, it must have been a brutal experience in itself. And as ransom, so that this would not be denied to me, I offered my blood, my flesh torn to shreds, and I let myself be stripped not only of my garments, but also of my skin. So Louisa describes him in the Hours of the Passion as like a skinned lamb, which, of course, is an exact description of what Isaiah said he would be. But also my skin, to be able to pay the price and to satisfy for the crime of this nakedness of man. I poured out so much blood in this mystery that in no other did I pour out so much. Isn't that interesting? So much as to be enough to cover him with a second garment, the garment of blood. Now, put there Revelation 7:14, where you will read that in the end, that the saints will be washed white in the blood of the Lamb. Washed white in the blood of the Lamb. And before you get to the end, that washing white in the blood of the Lamb is in the sacrament of penance. Okay. So a garment of blood so as to cover him again and then warm him and wash him to dispose him to receive the royal garment of my will. On hearing this, Louisa was surprised and she said, "My beloved Jesus, how can it be possible that because he withdrew from your will, man felt the need to clothe himself, was ashamed and afraid and so on? But then you always did the will of the celestial Father." Watch this. She never lets him off with anything. Not anything. "You did the will of the celestial Father. You were one with him, and your mother never knew her own will. And yet the two of you needed clothing and food, and you needed, you never felt, and you felt the cold and the heat." Of course, Jesus says to Satan, "Do you mind if the two of us went naked in our society? Don't you think we'd be strong from the first tree?" He had to adapt to the society he came to. But he tells her much more delicately than I've said it to you. And Jesus added, "Yet, my daughter, it is precisely so. If man felt ashamed of his nakedness and was subject to many natural miseries, it was precisely because he lost the sweet enchantment of my will. And even though it was his soul that did the evil, not his body, the body, however, indirectly was as though an accomplice with the wicked will of man. And so his nature remained as though profaned by the bad will of man." So the body had to suffer from the soul. "Therefore, both the soul and the body had to feel the pain of the evil that was committed. As for me, indeed, I always did the supreme will, but I did not come to find man innocent." That's Romans 5:8. "I did not come to find a man before sin. Rather, I came to find a sinful man with all of his miseries. And so I had to associate myself with men, taking upon myself all of their evils and subjecting myself to all the necessities of life as if I were one of them." Okay. Now, he's doing that also to redo the whole of humanity, but he's just not covering the subject of redoing the whole of humanity here. I want to give you 1 Corinthians 9:22. "I make myself all things for all men, hoping to redeem them. However, in me there was this prodigy. If I wanted, I would need nothing, either clothing or food or anything else. But I did not want to make use of it out of love for man. I wanted to sacrifice myself in everything, even in the most innocent things created by me, in order to prove my ardent love for him." Now, that's taught eloquently in volumes 1 to 4, trying to get us to do the same thing, that we would sacrifice in order to bring souls to him. And I also want to give you 1 Corinthians 8, verses 7 to 13. even more. This served to intercede with my Heavenly Father that out of regard for me and for my completely sacrificed will to him, that he would give back to man the royal garment of his will. So every single detail in the life of Jesus is making reparation for all the results of the fall and pleading for the divine will to be given back to us. I think that's a beautiful passage, isn't it? So January the 20th, we're naturally enough talking about the divine will. I was in the hard state of my usual privations of my beloved good, Louisa said, and I felt immersed in bitterness, knock out the two words, letters at the end, without the one who alone makes the sun, the warmth, the smile, the happiness arise in my poor soul. Now, Louisa is suffering because it seems to her that the person who is the source of all her happiness and everything else is being removed. So she's actually illustrating the happiness that comes from living in the divine will. Without him, it's always nighttime. Now, you see, the sinner is like that, that without the divine will, it's always night. I remained numb with the cold of his privation and I am unhappy. So she's actually experiencing what Adam experienced, but on a completely different level, that without him, this is how I am. With him, I'm totally happy. So I was feeling oppressed and my sweet Jesus moving in my interior, the kingdom of God is within you. So that's Luke 17, 21. He said, my daughter, courage, do not leave yourself prey to oppression. This is very important. And I want to give you 2 Corinthians 2, 11. 2 Corinthians 2, 11. And I want to give you Ephesians 4, 27. Okay, you're feeling the bitterness of the privation, but if you let it in on you yourself emotionally, you're going to allow oppression, and guess who's going to sit on it? Okay, always looking for an opportunity. So you've got to push this oppression out. If you knew how much I suffer in seeing you suffer, because the two of them are one, aren't they? I suffer so much that in order not to see you suffer so much, I put you to sleep. But I remain close to you and I don't leave you. And while you sleep, I do for you what we should be doing together. I think that's absolutely beautiful, isn't it? Okay. Now, if I was having to illustrate this in a little seminar, I would say, think of a daddy sitting on the bedside and the child is sleeping, and the daddy has helped the child to sleep with a little bit of medication because the child is going through a rough time. And what you're looking at is tenderness. What you're looking at is love. What you're looking at is someone really caring about the other. Okay. So he says, that's what I do for you. So while you sleep, I do for you what we should be doing together, and if we were awake, because it's not you who wants to sleep, it is I who want it. And this is why I make up for you. So I want to give you 2 things there. One is footprints, and the other is Psalm 127, verse 2. The Lord is my light and my salvation. What should I fear? Okay. Do you see how much I love you? Jesus said. If you knew how much I suffer when I see you wake up fidgeting because you have not perceived that I was close to you, since I myself have put you to sleep in the torment of my privation. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. It's true that you suffer. I too suffer. But it is the bond of my will that flows in you also in this. And clasping you more renders our union more stable. He's saying to her, the privation is also part of the divine will. The scripture says the just man lives by faith. Okay, that only came to me now, so I don't have the reference. And so Louisa has to experience her being as a creature and him in his heaven, if I can put it that way. But that doesn't take away from the fact that you are one with him. So whether you are praying in coldness or lukewarmness or anything else, it doesn't change the reality that he's there and you're there and the two of you are actually in union. It just simply means that emotionally you feel different, and we have to be careful not to let the emotions take over. Therefore, I want you to have courage and remember that you are my little boat. Now, my little boat, have you got the reference for that? Mm-hmm. No, in your book, the reference for that is February the 4th, 1921, volume 13. Now, you can look that up yourself. Louisa is the Lord's little boat. February the 4th, 1921, volume 13. You are my little boat. So she is the little boat sailing on the sea of the divine will. Okay. Now, St. Therese also spoke of herself as a little boat and that the Holy Spirit were the sails bringing this little boat through the sea of life. So you are my little boat in my will, and the divine will is not a sea of water which has its ports and shores where boats, ships and passengers make their stops. They take rest, they give themselves to amusements, and many passengers do not even return to cross the sea again. The sea of my will is a sea of light. It is a sea of fire without a port and without any shore. Now, Louisa will get eloquent on this when we get up into the volume 20s. Therefore, there are no stops for my little boat. She must cross it continuously, but with such speed as to enclose the whole of the endless eternity in each one of your heartbeats and acts, in such a way as to connect them to the eternal heartbeat and act, which is the heartbeat of each and every one. Of course, you can't do that except in the divine will. And you, crossing over all, will do the round of eternity in each heartbeat of yours. You will take everything and will bring us all that comes from the divinity in order for it to give and to receive. But while it gives, it does not receive. And my little boat has the task to cross the immense sea of my will in order to requite us for everything that comes from us. That's our response now in rounds and thanksgiving and everything else. So if you oppress yourself, you will lose the attentiveness of the round and the sea of my will. Not feeling agitated by the speedy rounds of my little boat will burn you more. Now, notice the sea needs to be agitated by the little rounds. In other words, it's like if you throw a stone into a lake, you're going to get these wonderful tiny little waves. OK, and the Lord is saying you must touch the divine will with your action, with your movement, just as the little stone touches the water. And if you don't do it, you'll burn more. Now, if you were with me for studying Jeremiah, Jeremiah was quite clear about that, that at one stage he didn't want to give God's messages anymore because he was given bad news all the time and they were giving him a hard time. And then he said, but when I tried to keep it in, he said, the word burned in my soul and the only way to release it was to actually give it. Okay, you will burn more. And you will fidget more because of my privation. But if you keep going around, you will be like the sweet little breeze, which while bringing refreshment to our fire, will serve you to sweeten the torment you suffer because of my privation. Now, Jeremiah 15:18 said to the Lord, my suffering is continual. And that was why he was tempted not to say everything. Now, Louisa has been grossly tempted not to say everything. And you meet that very particularly in the first 10 volumes, that she really doesn't want to say everything. And she discovers that things don't improve when you don't say everything. So January the 23rd are the three fiats. Okay. I was abandoning all of myself in the holy will of God, and I thought to myself, the fiat formed the whole universe. And in the fiat, the divinity made display of its love. And this display was made towards man, exposing it in each created thing in such a way that impressed in each created thing, one can see that fiat with such great mastery, power and harmony was released from the divine bosom towards the creature. Now, the Psalms are full of rounds of creation. You know that, don't you? So I suggest that you could put in there the last five Psalms. They're all Psalms of praise to God. They're all the Hallel. That's praise. Praising God for his redemption. I call it the rounds of not redemption, creation. I call it the rounds of creation, the last five. They're wonderful. So if you get tired doing your own rounds, try them. They're actually very wonderful. So the fiat formed the redemption. Here's the second fiat. So much so that in each thing which the eternal word did, the fiat is present and surrounded them like a crown. It gives them life. So the creating fiat and the redeeming fiat are braided together. She loves the word braided because she does embroidery. And one echoes within the other, forming one single fiat. And there's no created act which my sweet Jesus did not braid with the requital of his fiat. Now, my adored Jesus has told me many times that the third fiat is needed so that the works of creation and redemption may be completed. So how will this be done? Who will form so many fiats as to braid the creating fiat and the redeeming fiat? While I was thinking of this, my adorable Jesus moving in my interior, which is Luke 17:21. My daughter, he said, if the Supreme Majesty released so much love towards mankind in all the things created in the omnipotent fiat, it was right that I, his son, in the same fiat, would do as many acts to requite him for his love, braiding his fiat with mine. Now notice, as many acts, the Creator and the Redeemer, they do the same number of acts, they cover everything. Okay? So braiding his fiat, that's creation, with mine, which is redemption. So that another fiat, human and divine, which of course is Jesus, might rise from the earth to exchange the kiss with his fiat, be braided with it, and substitute for the return of love of all creatures. So Jesus does the same number of acts as done in the creating fiat. He substitutes for all the response that should be coming back from the earth. So he is speaking not just in his own name, but in the name of everyone from Adam to Zachary, A to Z. So, until I came upon the earth, the fiat which was spread throughout creation was by itself. But as I came, it was no longer alone. Indeed, my first task was that of forming as many acts in the eternal fiat for as many acts as my Father had done in creation. So, with my fiat, the creating fiat had its most harmonious company. Okay, but we have to have a trinity. Mm. Everything has to be done in threes. Okay, now, the fiat does not want to remain in two, it wants a third. Let me give you this quick before we even read it. The bride has to say yes. Louisa is representing the bride. Okay. And when you go to the end of the book of Revelation, you're going to hear just before his return, the Spirit and the bride say, come. So that means the divine will is really on the earth. Okay. So the Spirit and the bride must say yes. That's Revelation 22:17. That's just to put it in some kind of perspective for you. So the fiat does not want to remain in two. It wants a third one. It wants to be in three. And this third fiat is you. You're the one that must do it. In other words, Louisa is the drop of water representing all of us. This is why many times I have drawn you outside of yourself and I've placed you within that very creating and redeeming fiat so that you might do your flight as you would braid your fiat with ours. The creating and redeeming fiat might be braided by the third fiat, which is your own. Now, one of the most astonishing things about God is his humility. Why should God be humble? And why would God let an ordinary creature who had been born with original sin like everybody else and struggling to try and come to some kind of relationship with him, why would he say, you do the third one? To me, that's beyond imagining. I don't think we grasp anything of the humility of God. And I think the problem we have all the time in the spiritual life is that the Lord is humbler than all of us. And we think we're humble and our little heads have to be pushed up and you have to recognise me, you know. And you've got to say thanks and everything and you've got to appreciate me and everything. We don't realise that that's popping up. You know, I'm important, I have to be noticed and all the rest of it. We don't realise that's the ego saying, excuse me, but I'm not dead yet. And our problem is that the King is humbler than us all. That's what Paul says in Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Yeah, he's the humblest yet. Philippians 2, 1 to 11. And Paul says, our mind must be like his. We must start thinking like him. It's easier said than done, isn't it? And we keep on thinking we've done it and then a little test and you realise, no, I didn't do it yet. The more you operate in our fiat, the sooner you will reach the way of our fiat. And just as in the fiat of creation, many prodigious and beautiful things, the whole universe came out of us, and in the fiat of redemption substituted for all the acts of creatures, taking its lost child, there's your Luke 15 again, the prodigal son is the human race. The prodigal son is the human race. Taking its lost child by the hand to lead him back into the bosom of his celestial father, so will the third fiat, once it has done its court, let its effects be seen. That my will be known and loved, and that my will take its dominion in order to have its kingdom upon the earth. Each additional act of yours, which you will braid with our fiat, will be a human kiss that you will have our fiat be given, a greater bond that you will form between the divine will and the human will, in such a way that, placed in accord, it may have no reluctance to making itself known and taking its royal dominion. We have to really look at this. The Lord is looking for a throne on the earth. He's looking for a temple on the earth. He's looking for a place to reign on the earth. And all of that is in us, okay? Everything is in making itself known. This is terribly important. The rest will come by itself. This is why many times I have recommended to you that you omit to write nothing of what regards of my will, because knowledge is the way. Here you have it as clear as daylight. Knowledge is the way. And its light serves as a trumpet. The trumpet now is the shofar, the ram's horn. A trumpet to call those who are listening to make itself heard. And the more the trumpet sounds, it sounds more for as much more knowledge as it has to be manifested. So the more people know, the more the trumpet is sounding. In other words, the more we study the divine will and try and take it in, the more the trumpet is sounding in heaven, I'm coming. I'm coming, and eventually we'll hear it on the earth. I want to give you a number of references there. Hosea 4:6. Without knowledge, the people perish. Jeremiah 5:4. Proverbs 29:18. And Luke 11:52. So, and it sounds more, for as much more knowledge as it has to be manifested, the more people will rush up. Knowledge takes the attitude now of the pulpit, and then of a teacher, then of a compassionate father, and then of an excessive lover. In other words, as the knowledge really sinks in, we begin to grasp it, the Lord comes to us as a compassionate father, as an excessive lover, as a teacher, as a healer, and all the rest. He'll do anything to get through to us. In some, it has all the ways in its power in order to enter the hearts, to conquer them, and to triumph in everything. And the more knowledge it contains, the more ways it has in its power. Now, because of the time, I'm going to stop there and we'll take this up next week. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. I think that's important because we need the discipline as well.